Jewish ritual murder. A charge leveled against Jews, reaching back over 20 centuries of history. In medieval Europe, the Middle East, and the United States, the Jews have been accused of abducting a Gentile adult or child in conjunction with Jewish Passover and Purim holidays. The victims would be grotesquely tortured, exsanguinated, and then ritually murdered, often as an inversion and mockery to the crucifixion of Christ. The blood would be consumed or preserved for other purposes. There is also the sister charge, that of host desecration, where Jews were accused of stealing Eucharistic hosts, believed to be the actual flesh of Christ, and defile them. The Jews would counter these charges, and in the 1800s the label blood libel would begin to be used.
Blood libel, the outrageous and dangerous myth that Jews murder non-Jews to use their blood for religious rituals, has fueled anti-Semitism and violence for centuries.
What you just said, that Israel killed 12,000 children and they killed them all, this is a blood libel. This is rank anti-Semitism that we have suffered for 2,000 years.
I'm getting drunk on Christian blood, so let's do it the right
way.
So good.
They claim that these accusations arose from religious prejudice, economic resentment, or scapegoating, by blaming the minority Jews for all societal ills. They highlight that many of the confessions obtained in these cases were through torture, meaning they should not be taken as historical evidence. The Jews would be largely successful in turning these accusations to yet another baseless anti-Semitic trope. The subject of Jewish ritual murder is a long and dark one, filled with all sorts of claims, some plausible, and others less so, and as such it needs to be treated carefully. In the early 2000s, three Jewish scholars released works that drew backlash from the Jewish community. The most famous was Passovers of Blood by Ariel Toaff. Toaff would pull the first edition from circulation after receiving pressure. And the other works, Two Nations in Your Womb by Israel Yuval, and Reckless Rites by Eliot Horowitz. These works emboldened those who believe there is truth to the accusations of Jewish ritual murder. These believers hold to a theory that anti-Gentile violence and ritual murder go back to Second Temple Judaism and all the way through the Dark Ages, where Jews gained power and ritual murder became more frequent and normalized. This was broken by mass expulsions. Either the Jews did nothing wrong, or we would have to believe that everywhere the Jews went, all over the world, there was a massive conspiracy to murder small children, drain them of blood, and then plant the corpses near the premises of Jews, or that a murder was actually committed, but out of blind hatred and incompetence, the Jews were blamed, and the real killers got away. Jewish ritual murder is again in the spotlight with the recent release of the Epstein files, leading people to believe that this practice had never stopped. And as Jewish power reached its zenith, modern accusations or evidence are ruthlessly suppressed. Let us explore if these accusations are libel or legitimate. Myth or murder? Are they simply the work of imagination, fueled by anti-Semitic hatred, or the dark rites of a race consumed by eternal vengeance? The first accusation of Jewish ritual murder was made by the Greek polymath Poseidonius and repeated by his pupil Apollonius Molon, the tutor of Julius Caesar and Marcus Tullius Cicero. The Greek scholar Appian of Alexandria would write in the first century about the incident, but the original texts are lost. What we have is a rebuttal from Jewish historian Flavius Josephus. This accusation begins with Antiochus IV Epiphanes, a king of the Seleucid Empire, abandoning his campaign against the Romans in Egypt. While there, he hears of a rebellion in Jerusalem and returns to storm the city with his army and also plunder treasures to fund more military actions. In the temple, Antiochus finds a secret room where a man is laying on a bed in front of a small table full of food. The man is a Greek, and he says that he was seized by the Jews and brought to the temple. A servant told the man that every year, the Jews kidnap a Greek, fatten him up, and then sacrifice him in the woods. They would taste of his entrails, and while burning the body, swear an oath of hostility against Greeks. How could this claim be true if the Old Testament strictly forbids human sacrifice, such as sacrificing children to the Canaanite deity, Molech, as stated in the book of Leviticus? God orders the Israelites to completely genocide the Canaanites, but they fail to do so. An angel of the Lord tells the Israelites that because they failed, the Canaanites will be thorns in their sides, and their gods will be a snare to them. Ezekiel chapter 20 confirms that some Israelites were indeed doing sacrifice against the wishes of God. This shows that perhaps not all Israelites were monotheists, and some were still worshipping Canaanite deities, such as Astarte and Asherah. The Carthaginians also received the Canaanite religion. Greek historian Diodorus Siculus writes that the Carthaginians were sacrificing their own children to Baal, but more recently were buying and nurturing children to be sacrificed, instead of using their own. If some Israelites were still worshipping Canaanite deities, they would have evolved to buying foreigners, and it is a short next step to kidnapping. The Suda, a massive 10th century Byzantine encyclopedia, cites a writer named Damocritus from the 1st century BC, who claims that every 7 years, the Jews kidnap a foreigner to sacrifice. In a different entry, the Suda claims the sacrifice timeline is every 3 years. The timelines of 3 and 7 years can seem like a discrepancy, but can both be explained to worship of Astarte. A blue moon event occurs every 3 years, which could bring joy or fear and require a sacrifice. Astarte is depicted with horns on her head, symbolizing the crescent moon. Every 7 years there is an astrological event, a Venus traveling between Earth and the Sun. Worship of Astarte was intimately associated with the planet Venus, and this unusual movement of the planet in this event could have required a sacrifice. Two other seemingly small details come from the Josephus writing. 1. The man is taken to the woods to be sacrificed and not in the temple. Throughout the Old Testament there are references to Asherah poles, made of living wood, which operated as ritual sacrifice centers. 2. The burning of the victim while reciting an oath of hostility will become a modus operandi later on in Europe. This event could perhaps be a forerunner to the Purim holiday, where Jews today still eat pastries that symbolize the flesh of Haman, who was defeated in the Book of Esther.
The three sides represent Haman's hat, or his ears, or our forefathers, or dice from the royal game of Ur. Who knows? There's all sorts of reasons given.
This treat has evolved in form and meaning over centuries of Jewish culture. The oldest written mention of Hamantaschen dates back to 16th century Italy. A Purim play by Yehuda Somo references a treat called Oznei Haman in Hebrew. The phrase literally translates to Haman's ears. Before you lose your appetite, don't worry. There is no evidence that his ears and head were ever separated.
Piecing together the small details, we can conclude that something like the original claim did in fact occur. It is not plausible to believe that Antiochus needed to concoct this story out of thin air in order to persecute the Jews. The Jews had already challenged his authority by staging a coup against Menelaus, a high priest he appointed. The violent attempt to seize power and the challenge to Seleucid authority was all the cause Antiochus needed. Moving on to late antiquity and the rise of Christianity, a mirrored hostility would arise between Jews and Christians, and the accusations of ritual murder evolve into anti-Christian mockery and vengeance. Christian historian Socrates Scholasticus is our source for the next charge that took place in a Syrian town called Imnestar, near the city of Antioch. He writes that Jews were drunk in the streets and scoffing at Christians. They grab a Christian boy and tie him to a cross. They crowd around mocking the boy and then begin to whip the child until he is dead. These drunken festivals were happening elsewhere, in Alexandria as well. 7 years prior to this incident, Byzantine Emperor Theodosius II instructs governors of the Roman Empire to prohibit Jews from setting fire to Armon in memory of his past punishment in a certain ceremony of their festival, and from burning sacrilegious intent a form made to resemble the saint's cross in contempt of the Christian faith. Amon is Haman, and the festival is Purim. The edict shows the Jews were strapping an effigy of Haman to a cross and burning it. But in Imnestar, the effigy was a real Christian boy. Of this incident, Toph writes, the ritual of Purim did not always end with the bloodless hanging of a mere effigy of Haman. Sometimes the effigy was a flesh and blood Christian, crucified for real during the wild revelry of the Jewish carnival. Years later in Alexandria, around the same time of the Imnestar incident, Bishop Cyril was taking aggressive actions against pagans and Jews. Scholasticus writes that the Jews, on their Sabbath, instead of adhering to their laws or spending the day in prayer, were going to theater and dance performances, and this would turn into large gatherings and eventually disorder. An edict is issued by a Roman prefect to regulate these shows, and it is read out loud at a theater. This causes a massive riot, and Christians are killed by Jews. Bishop Cyril responds with leading a mob to sack Jewish synagogues, and the Jews are expelled from the city of Alexandria. Again, we are told by historians that this was all fabricated, and that Christians, for no reason other than hatred, decided to burn synagogues. We have two sources describing similar events and the actions of Jews, and no evidence proving this event was fabricated. In the next 700 years, we have a gap of Jewish ritual murder either being less active or better concealed. There are two incidents of Jewish massacres against Christians that are rarely talked about. The Jews would find an ally against the Christians with the Persian Empire. In the ancient city of Najran, what is now southwestern Saudi Arabia, King Dunuwas, a convert to Judaism, assassinates a pro-Christian king and pursues more pro-Persian policies. Najran was a city with a strong Christian center. Dunuwas gives the order to his Jewish-run military that the Christians must convert to Judaism or die. Most Christians choose death and are burned alive in a large trench, a truly biblical holocaust or burnt offering. claiming the lives of between 4 and 20,000. A rock inscription remains from one of the Jewish commanders, reading that the massacre was carried out by the Lord of Jews, by the highly praised. The next massacre was in Jerusalem less than 100 years later. The Jews would actively aid the Persian army in capturing the city from the Byzantine Christians. A contemporary Christian source, Antiochus Strategos, writes that after the fall, the Jews purchased thousands of Christian captives and slaughtered them at a water reservoir called Mamilla Pool. Archaeological excavations from the area find that the skeletons are mostly non-combatants, those of adult women and children. Jewish ritual murder was most likely cloaked in conflicts during the Arab-Byzantine Wars and the Muslim invasion of Spain, where again Jews would help Arabs and would bring forth the Jewish Golden Age. In the Middle Ages, many kings and noblemen will have Jews working for them and seen as essential. The Jews' close connection to tax collecting and money lending would do little to enhance their popularity. We will also see the Christian discovery of the Jewish Talmud. The Kabbalah and the Zohar also appear during this time. In the Middle Ages, Jewish ritual murder accusations will be more frequent, more grotesque, and the Christian backlash more severe. A 12-year-old boy named William goes missing on the eve of Passover. His corpse would eventually be found in Thorpe Wood, with countless cuts and stab wounds. A Benedictine monk, Thomas of Monmouth, would write of the incident in hopes that William would be canonized as a saint. A man claiming to be a cook for the archdeacon pays William's mother to let the boy come work with him as an apprentice. William is taken to the home of a prominent wealthy Jew, where he is treated well at first, but during dinner he is grabbed by the Jews. They insert a teasel into the boy's mouth, a dried plant with hard thistles, attached with straps that are tied at the back of the head. The boy's head is then shaved. He is tied to a cross, and they torture the boy, stabbing him all over his body. They stab his head in a mockery to the crown of thorns. At the end, he is stabbed through the side and the blade pierces his heart. The body is transported to the opposite side of the city by horseback. One rich merchant supposedly saw the Jews transporting it, but no investigation would happen because the Jews were under special protection from the king and they had bribed officials. Thomas of Monmouth writes that after a proper burial, miracles began to happen, and he documents these miracles across 5 books. People would travel from far to visit the shrine and ask the little martyr for a miracle. Despite his popularity, William of Norwich would not be canonized as a saint, but people would still venerate him throughout the late Middle Ages. The shrine and relics would eventually be destroyed when the Protestant Reformation swept through England. The Thomas of Monmouth writings also contain a testimony from a monk called Brother Theobald, a Jewish convert. Theobald said that in the ancient writings of Jewish ancestors, it was written that Jews could not achieve freedom or return to the lands of their fathers without shedding blood. And it was decided that every year, a Christian somewhere would be sacrificed as revenge against Christ, whom they blame for the exclusion from their fatherland. He says that the location for the yearly murder is chosen randomly by either the Jews in Spain or in Narbonne, France. In 1144, Norwich was chosen, and Theobald, who at the time was a Jew in Cambridge, was told of the murder. Hearing about the miracles associated to William afterwards is what he says inspired him to convert. Theobald must have been a Jew, because he knew that in Narbonne, France, a major center of Jewish learning and scholarship, was where the Nasi resided. The Nasi is a Jewish prince who claims direct descent from the line of David. A similar case would happen in Winchester, England, in the year 1190. The source, a monastic writer, Richard of Devizes, records the story of a French orphan boy who is told by a Jew that he should travel to England to find an apprenticeship. The boy is given a letter in Hebrew to carry with him and told to go directly to the city of Winchester and nowhere else. The French boy brings a friend with him to travel, who is also a poor orphan. The boy becomes a cobbler's apprentice to Jews, and the friend works elsewhere, but every night they sleep in the same room. One night, the friend waits for the boy to return from work, and he never shows. That day, it was Passover. The friend searches the city for days. When he asks the Jews about the disappearance, they suddenly treat him harshly. The boy realizes what the Jews did and yells publicly, drawing a crowd. A Christian woman who worked in the Jew's house said she saw the boy taken down to the cellar by a Jew, and only the Jew returned. A judge would dismiss the case because the boy was too young to swear an oath, and the woman's testimony was seen as untrustworthy because working for Jews was against church canon. There were also rumors the judge was bribed to drop the case. The Jewish man's insistence that the boy go directly to Winchester perhaps shows that it was decided by international jury that it was Winchester's turn that year. Murder returns to Winchester again in 1232. This time, a one-year-old boy, the body found in a church courtyard, strangled to death, the hands and feet chopped off, castrated, and the eyes and heart removed. The boy's nurse had sold him to a Jew named Abraham Pinch, while the boy's mother was sick. The boy is killed in Pinch's home with other Jews present. The only record of this case is from the findings of a jury. It finishes with a sheriff arresting Jews, and they are released after paying 20 marks, the equivalent today of £40,000. Throughout 13th century England, anti-Christian mockery and violence would persist. A deacon, who converted to Judaism for a woman, urinates on a cross in Oxford. He is burned at the stake for heresy. Also in Oxford, a Jew attacks a Christian procession and damages the cross. King Henry III orders the Jews to pay for a new cross, the base of which is still in an Oxford museum. In Lincoln, England, a Jew named Copin lures a 9-year-old boy named Hugh into his home. The boy is whipped, crowned with thorns, and strapped to a cross. Copin confesses to this murder and says that it is customary for Jews to sacrifice a child annually. The body of little Saint Hugh is found in his own well. King Henry III approves of the execution of Copin and 18 other Jews. Geoffrey Chaucer would write in the Canterbury Tales, "O young Hugh of Lincoln, slain also by cursed Jews." Multiple churches in Norwich are robbed by Jews and some Christian accomplices. They steal valuable items and desecrate the Eucharist by trampling on it. This would fuel even more anti-Jewish sentiment, and in 1290, Edward I expels the Jews from England. The first charge of ritual murder in France led to the execution of between 30 and 40 Jews. Two competing accounts of the event are by a German Jewish scholar named Ephraim ben Jacob and the Norman monk Robert of Torini. Ben Jacob's story is that a man's horse is startled after hearing a loud splash in the Loire River. This leads him to believe that the Jews dumped a body. The entire Jewish community is arrested. Even though no body is ever found, and no one reported a child missing. Count Theobald V has a Jewish mistress named Pulcelina, a rich moneylender. She tries to persuade him to let the Jews go. In the end, her and her daughters are also burned along with the other Jews. Robert of Torini writes that the Jews had crucified a child at Easter, in contempt of Christians, and that the body was actually found in the Loire River. Modern historians want us to believe that all of these Jews were burned over a splash, and no other evidence. 8 years later, the body of another boy is found with evidence of crucifixion and drained of blood after Passover. The victim is a 12-year-old boy named Richard. He receives a martyr's burial at the Cemetery of the Holy Innocents. Philip II, the 15-year-old king, is deeply outraged by the killing. The king's chaplain, Father Philippe de Rigard, a Jewish convert, writes, "The Jews who dwelt in Paris, every year, on Easter Day, or during the sacred week of our Lord's Passion, go down secretly into underground vaults and kill a Christian as a sort of sacrifice, in contempt of the Christian religion." King Philip expels Jews from the royal domain of France in 1182, but they are still allowed in French territories. A Jewish man is reportedly killed by a Christian. Countess Blanche of Champagne gives the Jews permission to execute the man on Purim in commemoration of Haman. The man is killed as a mockery to Christ. King Philip hears of this, invades the town and burns over 80 Jews. 2 years later, the Countess Agnes de Dreux gives a murdering thief over to the Jews. The Jews crucify him and drain him of blood. A 2-year-old Christian girl is found dead in the city moat, with ritual stab wounds. The Jews confess under torture. 10 Jews are killed by a mob after a dead child is found with ritual stab wounds. In Paris, the church would recognize and approve a miracle. A Christian woman pawned some of her belongings to a Jewish pawnbroker. He tells her if she wants her things back, to bring him a consecrated host from the church. On Easter Sunday, she returns with the host, and the man takes it to his home. The man stabs the host, and it begins to bleed. He panics and throws the host into boiling water. The host levitates out, glows and turns into the shape of a cross. He puts the host in a basin and gives it to a pious woman. The woman takes it to the church. The pawnbroker is convicted and burned at the stake. His home is converted into a chapel that still stands today. The host, however, was lost during the French Revolution. The Jews are expelled again in 1306 by King Philip IV. And a final time, in 1394, under King Charles. On Christmas Day, 5 children are killed in a fire while their parents are at church. It is believed by the locals that Jews killed them and drained them of blood. Crusaders who were in the area help a mob in killing over 30 Jews. Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II is given conflicting data from church authorities on the matter. He assembles Jewish converts to Christianity for an investigation. The converts say that Jewish law strictly forbids consuming any blood. The emperor then exonerates the Jews of this crime. 11 Jews are executed after admitting under torture to murdering a child. The same year, an entire community of Jews are burned at the stake for host desecration. The hill they were burned on was named Jew Hill until 1945. In 1247, Pope Innocent IV issues a declaration against mob violence towards Jews. Just 3 years prior, Pope Innocent ordered Louis IX of France to burn all copies of the Talmud. Accusations against Jews and mob violence would not stop. In Munich, a synagogue is burned, killing over 180 Jews inside. The body of a 16-year-old boy named Werner is found floating in the Rhine River. On Holy Thursday, it was believed the Jews had lured the boy into a home and tortured him for 3 days. He was hung upside down and completely drained of blood. Anti-Jewish violence erupts all over the Rhineland, and King Rudolf I intervenes, not believing in the accusations. He orders the body of Werner burned. Werner was venerated until 1963 as the patron saint of winemaking because he worked in a vineyard. In 1298, a German nobleman named Rindfleisch would start a massacre. When Jews in his area are accused of host desecration, he declares that he has received a mandate from heaven to avenge the sacrilege. After burning the Jews in his hometown of Rortingen, he and his mob destroy over 100 Jewish communities and kill between 20 and 100,000 Jews. In Nuremberg, the Jews seek refuge in a fortress with the help of some Christians, but Rindfleisch overpowers them and kills all the Jews. Israel Yuval documents Jewish chroniclers who wrote of Jews ritually sacrificing their own children during German pogroms instead of having them be forcibly converted. The women there girded their loins with strength and slew their sons and their daughters and then themselves. Many men too plucked up courage and killed their wives, their sons, their infants. Those who were slain exposed their throats for their heads to be severed, also slaughtering one another, man, his friend, his kin, his wife, his children. Are we to believe that the Jews wouldn't ritually sacrifice Christian children when they were sacrificing their own? The Jews in Spain opened the gates of Toledo to Muslim invaders while Christians were worshipping during Palm Sunday. It was a massive turning point at the heart of Spain that led to the Muslims controlling up to 90% of the Iberian Peninsula. The Jews thrived as a protected class, having an intellectual and cultural renaissance called the Jewish Golden Age. Jewish merchants were critical in the medieval slave trade. Jews played a significant role in bringing slaves into Spain and castrating the males, because Muslim law prohibited castration. Slavic women were also in high demand for harems and as concubines, valued for their light complexion and exotic appeal. As the Spanish reclaimed land during the Reconquista, accusations of Jewish ritual murder began to emerge. A 7-year-old choir boy named Domingo is kidnapped by a Jew and given to a death cult. Jews are convicted of crucifying the boy. Domingo is still venerated as the patron saint of choir boys today. Forced conversions of Jews occur all over Spain. Some Jews move to the islands. On Good Friday, Jews crucify a Muslim boy instead of a Christian. prominent members of the Jewish community are put to death. The rest of the island is forced to be baptized or die. The Jews and Muslims who converted were secretly practicing their old faith. Pope Sixtus IV authorizes King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella to start the Inquisition. Public opinion would turn against the Inquisition, until a chief inquisitor is assassinated by five Jews while he is about to receive communion. Peter of Arbuse would be canonized as a saint. A mix of nine converts and Jews admit to crucifying a boy in a cave. They are all executed. The victim is known as the Holy Child of LaGuardia. Historians say no body or evidence was produced. The Archdiocese of Madrid published an article in 2015, asserting that the events had actually taken place. After the Christian conquest was complete, Ferdinand and Isabella issue a decree ordering all unconverted Jews to leave Spain. As Europe enters the Renaissance era, we will see some of the most famous accusations against the Jews. Three Jewish merchants are returning from a fair. While walking through a small village, they come across a three-year-old boy named Andreas. The Jews find out that the mother is far from home reaping wheat, and the boy is in the care of his godfather. They get the man drunk and convince him to sell the child, promising he will have a better life of ease and comfort. The child is sold for a handful of gold coins. The Jews take the child into the woods, slaughter him on a boulder, and collect his blood. The mother would discover the body later. The godfather is interrogated and confesses to selling the child. He is condemned to perpetual imprisonment in his own house. The village would be renamed Judenstein, meaning Jewstone. A church was built around the boulder, and for centuries was a site for Christian pilgrimage. In 1994, Bishop Reinhold Stecker banned the veneration, removed the relics from the church, and forbid the pilgrimage due to its anti-Semitic nature. The stone is now used to display the agony of Jesus in the garden. What were the Jews actually doing with the Christian blood they extracted? Our next case, one of the most documented murders by Jews, will give us direct insight into the ritual and the use of the blood. The case is similar to the ones before, but the difference here is most of the records from the trials still survive today. A two-year-old boy named Simon is abducted on Holy Thursday. He was last seen sitting on the steps of his home. He is approached by a Jew named Tobias, a doctor and a surgeon who was skilled with the use of knives. Tobias leads the boy to the house of a wealthy Jew named Samuel. The body is discovered days later, by Jews, in the Adige River, not far from the house of Samuel. There were multiple wounds and incisions on the boy's body, also evidence showing he was recently circumcised. It was clear the boy didn't drown, as his body had barely any blood left in it. The suspects were arrested and interrogated in the castle of Bunconsiglio. Italian Jews would go to great lengths to free them. The Jews bribed officials and schemed to break the prisoners out of jail. When this failed, they tried to assassinate the lead bishop overseeing the trials by poisoning his food. However, the bishop was employing three taste testers. The assassin was a Jewish convert. He was arrested and executed. Ariel Toaff discovered that there indeed was a black market trade of Christian blood used for medical purposes and for ritual rites. He writes, reading the depositions, one is left with the clear impression that rather than explain the need for the blood of a Christian child, the defendants were attempting to provide a description of the wonderful therapeutic and magical properties of blood generally, and of blood extracted from children and young persons in particular. The Jews would use powdered blood as a hemostatic agent, or coagulant, to be used after circumcision. Toaff writes that Kabbalistic texts and remedy books from German Jewish communities, even into modern times, repeatedly prescribe young blood as highly effective for circumcision wounds and bleeding. Toaff also writes of another grotesque Ashkenazi custom. During the circumcision ceremony, women who have not produced a male child will fight over the recently cut foreskin to be the first to eat it. The same way women today at weddings wait for the toss of the bride's bouquet. Jewish shops in medieval Europe offered oils extracted from fetid mummies, medicines containing powdered human skull, and fat from human flesh, but these were never to be extracted from the bodies of dead Jews. Young Christian blood was a precious and much sought-after commodity. Numerous confessions of the trial show that blood was put into the dough to make pastries. It would also be stored and doled out to less fortunate Jews in the community. The patriarch of the family was responsible for obtaining the blood. In this case, it was Samuel. Samuel would also lead the ritual. He would recite the 10 plagues of Egypt and ask the Jewish God to bring these 10 plagues against the Gentiles. He sprinkles Simon's blood, mixed with wine, on a table, and in unison they all say, "Vomit your anger onto the nations which refuse to recognize you, and their kingdoms, which do not invoke your name, which have devoured Jacob and destroyed his seat. Turn your anger upon them, reach them with your scorn, persecute them with fury, cause them to perish from beneath the divine heaven." The evening before Passover, they knead Christian blood into the dough to prepare the unleavened bread. When the bread is baked, they poke holes in it and say, "Thus may our enemies be consumed," and the bread is ready to be eaten. They testified that ancient rabbinical tradition says the boy has to be under 7 years old and of the male sex. In doing this ritual, it inverts the passion of Christ. This practice was never written down and only transmitted orally. During the crucifixion, the Jews shout at the child saying things such as, "Thou shalt be martyred as Jesus, the hanged God of the Christians, was martyred, and thus may it happen to all our enemies." The Jews stamp on the ground rhythmically, as to drown out any memory or voice of the adversary. They make faces and stick their tongue out, or spit, show their bare buttocks, and make obscene hand gestures, such as one called the fig, which is an allusion to the vagina during sex. The day after Simon was killed, his corpse is displayed on the altar of the synagogue. A sermon is given against Jesus and the Virgin Mary, using the Talmud. The rabbi then makes the fig sign, slaps the corpse of the boy in the face, and spits on it. Other members follow suit, men and women, slapping, biting, and spitting on the corpse. The specifics of this ritual could not have been known to the inquisitors. Toaff writes, "These depositions describe exactly what was prohibited, what was permitted, and what was tolerated, all in meticulous detail. The murderers are put to death, either burned or beheaded, and the synagogue burned down, with a church built over it." It's important to note that Trent was a cosmopolitan city with virtually no record of anti-Semitism in the past. In 1965, the Archbishop of Trent, with no new evidence, declared the Jews were innocent, and Pope Paul VI would reverse Simon's veneration as a martyr. The remains of the child were put in a secret place to end the pilgrimage. The church would be in full control of two other cases in Italy, from beginning to end. The first is in Venice, where a boy named Sebastiano was murdered. The Jews responsible were publicly burned at the stake in Piazza San Marco. The same occurred 5 years later in Padua, to a boy named Lorenzino. Throughout the 15th and 16th century, Jews were forced to wear distinct clothing for identification. Northern Italy would mandate a yellow circular badge to be worn. Other areas would change this to a yellow hat, and the women wearing a yellow veil. In 1569, Pope Pius V issues a decree expelling Jews from the Papal States. One of the reasons was practicing magic, superstition, and witchcraft. The Pope portrayed Jewish presence as a spiritual disease, threatening Christian salvation. The expulsions of Jews from Western and Central Europe would push them to the East. And where they went, accusations of ritual murder persisted through the Enlightenment. Because of accusations of blood sacrifice and other factors, Catholic seminary students lead a bloody riot that devastated the Jewish quarter of the city. On the first day alone, over 100 Jews are killed and 200 wounded. A boy named Gabriel is abducted and has his blood drained over the course of 9 days. He is a canonized saint in the Eastern Orthodox Church. A prominent member of the Jewish community is convicted of murder. He has his head put on a stake and displayed publicly as a warning. A priest named Stefan Zukowski led the charge against the elder. He would go on to write books about Jewish ritual murder and commission painter Carol de Prevo to create depictions that would be hung in the cathedral. A Greek Orthodox monk and former Judaic rabbi writes a testimony on Jewish ritual murder, published in the beginning of the 19th century. The testimony confirms most of what we have already seen. He writes that he performed these rituals, being a former rabbi, but that not all Jews are aware of what he calls the blood secret, which is only transmitted orally and not written. The Jews who pass along this tradition are known as the keepers of the blood secret. Fathers who are initiated are only allowed to tell one son, the one that can be most trusted. The father lays a wreath on the son's head and explains in great detail the blood secret as the most sacred secret and the most important rite of the Judaic religion. The son is told not to tell his brothers, and especially no woman. Neophytos writes that the main reason Jews kill Christians and collect the blood is because rabbis secretly know Jesus is the Messiah, but refuse to accept it. For communities who do not have access to fresh Christian blood, rabbis will soak linen or cotton in the blood, let the cloth dry, then burn it and collect the ashes. The ashes are entrusted to the treasurer of the synagogue, and he mails it to communities in need. Before a wedding, a rabbi cuts a hard-boiled egg in half, sprinkles the ashes on each half, and the bride and groom eat it after fasting 24 hours. During Purim and Passover, every Jew, rich, poor, old, even the young with no teeth, must eat the unleavened bread. There would be many other ritual murders throughout Poland and Europe. As we approach the modern era and the rise of Jewish power, the charge against Jews will not slow down. But with Jewish control of the media and other institutions, making the charge stick will be a difficult task, due to the counter-accusation of anti-Semitic blood libel. In the 19th century, Jewish ritual murder accusations were so well known they began to influence literature. Grimm's fairy tales had more overt stories, such as The Jew's Stone, based on the Andreas of Rhin murder, and another story titled The Girl Who Was Killed by Jews, and then more subtle ones, such as Rumpelstiltskin, who demands a firstborn child, presumably to eat, and the evil witch of Hansel and Gretel, who is fattening up a child to devour. The Jew, like the witch in the woods, is seen as being on the outside of society, a foreign goblin, waiting to snatch up the unsuspecting. A fountain in Bern, Switzerland, called the Devourer of Children, is an obvious depiction of a Jew eating babies. In Bram Stoker's Dracula, the vampire is an Eastern European, with an aquiline nose, bushy eyebrows, and pointed ears. He has an aversion to Christian symbols. He gives his vampire followers children to drink blood from. He hoards wealth and seeks to infiltrate Britain and be an economic parasite. The character of Dracula was highly influenced by Svengali, a character in Georges Du Maurier's novel Trilby. He is an evil Ashkenazi Jew who hypnotizes and controls a woman to exploit her. The Jews were known throughout Europe as bloodsuckers, both figuratively as a usurer who drains you of all money, and literally as one who will drain and consume your blood. From Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, where the Jew Shylock demands a pound of flesh, to Mary Shelley's novel Valperga, with the line, "Thou vile Jew, a usurer, a bloodsucker." The Jew had cemented his reputation throughout Europe as a danger to the moral fabric of the people. But our next case brings us to the Middle East, to what is known as the Damascus Affair. Father Thomas, a friar from Sardinia, and his Muslim servant, Ibrahim Amara, disappear. The friar was well known for providing medical care and smallpox inoculations. He was last seen in the Jewish quarter, hanging a notice of an upcoming property auction near a synagogue. The auction would benefit charity. When he doesn't return, the Muslim servant goes to search for him. A Jewish barber named Salomon hangs the exact same notice outside of his shop, and this draws suspicion. He is arrested, interrogated, and tortured. Salomon names 8 prominent Jews, who bound and gagged Father Thomas and collected his blood. After this, they dismembered the body, put the pieces in bags, and stomped on the bones to turn it into powder and dump in a sewer. The Muslim servant received the same fate. The suspects were imprisoned for 7 months, and there was an international Jewish response to the incident. Jewish protests were had in London, Paris, and US cities to pressure Egyptian Viceroy Muhammad Ali Pasha to release the prisoners. The international pressure caused a halt to the torture, but between 2 and 4 Jews had already died. Some had their teeth pulled, were burned, beaten, and one converted to Islam and became an informant. The remaining Jews would be exonerated after pressure from Britain and Austria. The real murderers, apparently, were never found. In 1983, Syrian Defense Minister Mustafa Tilos published a book called Matzah of Zion, a historical study that revived interest in the Damascus Affair. He believed the ritual murder to be real, and that the Jews used the blood to mix into unleavened bread to eat. Russian Jews begin flooding into the East End of London, and soon after, a killer hunts at night, looking for female victims. He would become known as Jack the Ripper. The two most plausible suspects for the Ripper are Aaron Kosminski and David Cohen, both Jews. None of the women killed were Jewish. They were all killed in a way that is eerily similar to the Jewish ritual slaughter of animals, known as Shakita. The animal must be killed with one single, continuous, smooth incision. Four out of five of the Ripper victims have a shallow, practice cut, and then a final deep and smooth cut. These first four victims were killed outside, under pressure of being caught. The fifth victim, Mary Jane Kelly, was killed inside, and with only one smooth cut across the neck. The next step of Shakita is the removal and inspection of viscera to confirm the animal was healthy and did indeed die from the single throat cut. All of the Ripper victims had their organs removed except for the third victim, Elizabeth Stride, because it's believed the killer was interrupted. While it is highly likely the killer was of Jewish ethnicity, it is not likely that this is a classic Jewish ritual murder, as we have seen thus far. There is no whipping or torture, in a way to mock Christ. The blood of the victims was not collected to be used for unleavened bread. And none of the murders occurred near Purim or Passover. But our next murder will take place on Passover, in Prussia. And there will also be butchers. The body parts of a prep school student named Ernst Winter are found all over town 2 weeks after he went missing on Passover. Because of the skillful method of the dismemberment, butchers became the suspects. First a non-Jewish butcher, and then two kosher ones, father and son, Adolf and Moritz Louis. The story became a national media frenzy, and the people rioted against the Jewish communities to the point of needing military intervention. The father and son are brought to trial, but acquitted for lack of evidence. However, the son was convicted of perjury for saying he was not an acquaintance of the victim. Around this time, a 19-year-old Christian woman had gone missing. She was a seamstress named Agnes, and she disappeared on Ash Wednesday. Her body is found in the woods with one deep throat cut and barely any blood at the scene. The man accused was a Jew with below average intelligence, Leopold Hilsner, an unemployed shoemaker. He is charged with the murder of Agnes and another woman named Marie, who went missing before Agnes and her skeleton was found. He is sentenced to death, but it is reduced to life in prison. He serves 19 years of his sentence and is then pardoned by the Emperor of Austria-Hungary. There was only circumstantial evidence against him. It is clear that he could not have acted alone, as he was too weak and feeble to make the neck wound. Magically, though, women stopped disappearing from the area. Now in the 20th century, our next case will be the last Jewish ritual murder accusation to receive widespread international coverage. The body of a 12-year-old boy was found on the outskirts of Kiev, Russia, now modern-day Ukraine. The boy was killed on Purim and put into a cave, the body almost entirely drained of blood. During the funeral, pamphlets were handed out that said, "Orthodox Christians, the boy was tortured by kikes, so beat the kikes, drive them out, do not forgive the shedding of Orthodox blood." The far-right Russian group called Black Hundred led the charge against the Jews, and the main suspect was Menachem Mendel Baylis. He is almost killed by a bomb, and a mob attacks the prison wagon on the way to court. Due to lack of evidence, Baylis is acquitted, but the jury voted in favor of the killing being a Jewish ritual murder. The conclusion was unsatisfactory to the Russian people. As World War I loomed on the horizon, the case and the victim would soon be forgotten. Russia's involvement in World War I would end with the Bolshevik Revolution. Tsar Nicholas and the Romanov family would be murdered over a year later. The order to murder the Tsar and his family came down from Lenin, then passed from Yakov Sverdlov to Philip Golodshikin, and finally to the executioner Yakov Yurovsky. Everyone in this chain was Jewish. The family was brutally murdered over a long period of time, stabbed with bayonets, and then shot. There were rumors that the heads were removed and sent to Trotsky to perform a ritual. But when the remains were located in 1991, the heads were intact. Another rumor is that an occult message was written on the walls of the murder scene. The letters are not Aramaic, Hebrew, or Yiddish, and appear to be meaningless scrolls. The Romanov family was not subjected to ritual murder, but secular Jewish savagery. That of which the world would see throughout the 20th and 21st century. In the United States, the Jewish-run media would amplify any false accusation of ritual murder. A Slavic maid is helping a Jewish woman with the preparations of a circumcision ceremony when something frightens her. The girl flees the home, fearing she is going to be sacrificed, and goes into hiding. Rumors of blood sacrifice circulated among the Slavic immigrant community, but the girl was found safe, and no one was charged. The entire event died down in a few days, but Jews made sure the incident stayed in the headlines. That same year, on the Lower East Side, a woman kills her husband, claiming he had sold their son to Jews. The boy is found days later, unharmed. This was plastered all over the newspapers and used to discredit the Bayless case in Russia. Another story was that of a Polish-American boy who comes home limping. He tells his parents that rabbis captured him and extracted two vials of blood from his leg. The police go where the boy tells them it happened, and they find blood spatter on the wall, but it is found to be chicken blood. Finding any type of blood there is certainly a coincidence. The Anti-Defamation League dispatches a team to the area and meets with the parents. Shortly after, the boy says he invented the story, and the press runs with it. One of the most famous of these false accusations was in 1928. A four-year-old girl goes missing on Yom Kippur. Rumors swirl around that the Jews had killed her, and the police question a rabbi. 300 people gather around the police station. The girl was found in the woods unharmed, and the Jewish media responds. We will now enter an era where the Jews have more power than ever before.
As a child, my next guest was used also in worshiping the devil, participated in human sacrifice rituals and cannibalism. She says her family has been involved in rituals for generations. You come from generations of ritualistic abuse?
Yes, my family has an extensive family tree, and they keep track of who's been involved and who hasn't been involved. And it's gone back to, like, 1700.
Does everyone else think it's a nice Jewish family? From the outside, you appear to be a nice Jewish girl.
Definitely.
And you all are worshiping the devil inside the home?
Right. There's other Jewish families across the country. It's not just my own family.
Really?
If you grow up with something, you think it's normal.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of things went on in the family?
Well, there would be rituals in which babies would be sacrificed, and you would have to, you know...
Whose babies?
There were people who bred babies in our family. No one would know about it. A lot of people were overweight, so you couldn't tell if they were pregnant or not. Or they would supposedly go away for a while and then come back. When I was very young, I was forced to participate in that, in which I had to sacrifice an infant.
And the purpose of sacrifice is to what? Is to bring you what? What are you sacrificing for?
For power.
Uh-huh. Power.
Nobody would suspect anybody involved in it. There's police officers involved in it. There's, you know, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs involved in it. I mean, it's not the person, you know, who looks scummy that's involved in it. It's someone who looks normal. There's a book that I had just come across called Lilith's Cave, which is a book of Jewish mysticism and supernatural. And there's a lot in that book that relates to what I, you know, endured when I was a child.
I want to stop right here. I want to make it very clear. This is one Jewish person. So right. Don't go around now saying to people, you know those Jewish people, they're worshiping them. No. This is just one person.
It is clear that something very strange is going on with the elite members of society and celebrities. Every now and then, something slips through the cracks and the internet runs wild.
The elite are obsessed with the occult. You see, for over 120 plus years in Northern California, leaders from around the world travel there to engage in bizarre, ancient Canaanite, Luciferian, Babylon mystery religion ceremonies.
It is a mixture of the Babylonian Canaanite cult of Moloch, fused with ancient druidic rites, where you have the female side of Satan, which they first call out to.
And when these strange practices are uncovered, you will always find a Jew.
A wild discovery underneath a synagogue in Brooklyn.
An illegal tunnel found below the Chabad-Lubavitch world headquarters.
Guatemalan authorities raided the extremist Jewish cult Lev Tahor in Guatemala over the weekend, rescuing 160 children and teens from the community following allegations of rape, human trafficking, forced marriage, and other forms of abuse. Lev Tahor was founded in 1988 in Israel and is a known extremist cult.
In a practice known as Metzitza Bepe, or just MBP, the moyel actually uses his mouth to suck the blood from the infant's penis after he cuts off the foreskin.
What is this shit?
That stuff makes pure mescaline seem like ginger beer, man. Adrenochrome.
Adrenochrome?
The whole adrenochrome empire, this is a big deal. It is listed under the NIH. It is a chemical compound. It's a molecular structure. It's C9H9NO3. It's an elite drug that they've used for many years. It's 10 times more potent than heroin. And it has some mystical qualities as far as making you look younger.
Let's talk about this facial that you're obsessed with. Yeah. Explain what it is.
Well, it's this way in which one forces through microneedling.
What are you pushing into the skin?
It is an extraction from a piece of skin that came from a young person far, far away. And they somehow figured out how to extract.
It's foreskin from a Korean baby. That's what it is.
Religious charities controlled by prominent rabbis were used to launder cash. Prosecutors say one rabbi was dealing in human kidneys for transplant for a decade, buying them from vulnerable people at a huge profit.
I couldn't help but notice a very disturbing pattern emerging, which is that many of the predators, not all, but many of them, are Jews.
Since the Jews have massive influence over the power structures, it will never be known how many of these claims are fantasy and which ones are real until this influence is ended. It is unlikely that Jewish ritual murder stopped in the modern era. If anything, it became much worse. The Jews commit mass murder openly in front of the whole world. During the genocide of the Palestinians, reports emerged of soldiers stealing babies, never to be returned. The Jews see all who oppose them as Amalek from the Old Testament. Ironically, The term refers to blood liquors. For the Jews to win, Amalek must be destroyed.
We read in this week's Torah portion, remember what Amalek did to you. We remember, and we act.
From the Torah, one of the 613 commandments is to remember to erase the nation of Amalek, the memory of them even, not only physically to erase them from the face of the earth.
What's the difference between Edom and Amalek? We spoke about Edom being the grandfather of Amalek. Amalek is Germany, so who's Edom? Edom includes most of Europe. It includes the United States of America. It's the Roman Empire that was never destroyed.
We want to know what you're reading now.
What I'm reading?
Yeah.
It's a book by historian by the name of Barry Strauss, called The Jews Against Rome.
What made you pick it up?
Well, we lost that one. I think we have to win the next one.
With the recent war that has begun with Iran, the Jews launched the attack close to Purim and compared the killing of the Ayatollah to Haman.
Operation Epic Fury and Roaring Lion Shield of Judah is Mordecai Esther Purim. Decree destruction upon Haman, Ayatollah dead and blood moon. That is not an accident. That is not coincidence. That is orchestrated, and God's hand is in it right now. So these are very biblical prophetic events that we are watching unfold before our very eyes.
The Jews are blood drunk and dragging the world into another calamity. It is Jewish ritual murder on a mass scale, and it must be opposed. We must continue to shine a light on these devils as we approach our darkest hour. Through their massive influence and pressure, the Jews have wiped away almost all memory of our martyrs, covering for the crimes of their people. Even recently, the Jews protested the canonization of San Carlo Acutis, a 15-year-old boy who died of leukemia. San Carlo ran a website that documented Eucharistic miracles, including those with host desecration. He does not even explicitly mention Jews on his website. The Jews want to always appear as the eternal victims of mankind. And our people, knowing they consumed the blood of our children for centuries, would surely tarnish that image. Remember, these were all real victims. Innocent. Precious. And pure. The Jew knows that it is only we that can stop them, because there is power in our blood.
Would you be free from your burden of sin? There's power in the blood, power in the blood. Would you or evil a victory win? There's wonderful power in the blood. There is power, power, wonder-working power in the blood of the Lamb. There is power, power, wonder-working power in the precious blood of the Lamb.
Would you be free from your passion and pride?
There's power in the blood, power in the blood.
Come for a cleansing to Calvary's time.
There is power, wonder-working power
in the blood
of the Lamb. There is power, wonder-working power in the precious blood of the Lamb.
Would you do service for Jesus your King? There's power in the blood, power in the blood. Would you live daily His praises to sing?